Senate Committee on the Judiciary, Monday, April 18th, 3 p.m., room 346. That was 257. Laird Kirkpatrick?
Laird, you?
Kirkpatrick.
For the record, my name's Larry Kirkpatrick, School of Law, University of Oregon. I'm testifying on behalf of the Oregon State Bar in favor of House Bill 2257. I'm Chairman of the Procedure and Practice Committee of the Oregon State Bar. A number of other members of our committee and the Oregon State Bar are also here to testify in favor of this bill today. I thought it might be helpful for me to give some background regarding the bill and not get into the merits quite as much and allow some of the other attorneys to testify to that issue. And if there are questions regarding some of the issues raised, perhaps I'd have an opportunity to make remarks later in the hearing. This bill is similar to a bill that was introduced at the last session of the legislature. It's essentially modeled after Federal Rule 33, the federal interrogatory provision. To give a little bit of history regarding this proposal, Oregon currently has no written interrogatories. The majority of other states do have written interrogatories in state court. The only type of interrogatories we have in this state are really a method of submitting questions at depositions to a witness in written form, but they aren't really interrogatories in the true sense. And this legislation is legislation that was first proposed by the Oregon State Bar in 1974, and the interrogatories provision was endorsed by the Oregon State Bar at the 1974 Bar Convention after quite a bit of extended debate without limit as to number. The bar bill was introduced at the 1975 legislature. The House Judiciary Committee and Representative Myers in particular amended the bill significantly to conform more to the federal provision, Federal Rule 33, and the bill in that form did pass the House of Representatives of the 1975 legislature. It was not heard, or at least did not come out of this committee at the 1975 legislature. The Oregon State Bar at the 1976 convention again considered legislation to establish interrogatories that were recommended by the Procedure and Practice Committee. This time, the Procedure and Practice Committee, in an attempt to work out a compromise with those attorneys that do oppose the interrogatories provision, modified the bill. And the modification in the bill that you have before you is that the number of interrogatories is limited to 25. A number of attorneys were concerned about the possible burden that could be placed upon small practitioners or attorneys without MagCard typewriters by attorneys that were able to deluge them with interrogatories, and about the possible abuse. So the compromise was made that the interrogatories in the bill would be limited to 25, including subparts. And so the bill in that modified compromise form was submitted to the 1976 Oregon State Bar Convention. It was passed by the Oregon State Bar after debate and is recommended to this legislature. Extensive testimony was taken on this bill in the House. A number of attorneys testified in favor of the bill, and a number testified against the bill. By a substantial margin, the House Judiciary Committee passed out this legislation in the form that you have it before you. Some minor amendments were made, mostly on technical points. The substance of the legislation was not changed. I have some written testimony that goes through the bill section by section and basically explains what changes would be made by the bill and explains the purpose of each section. It should be noted that the bill does go beyond simply dealing with interrogatories. It also deals with some additional problems under Oregon procedure. The additional problems are the fact, for example, that Oregon has no statute at the current time that defines the scope of discovery. That defines the scope of discovery. There's a reference, cross-reference to this non-existent statute in the Oregon Discovery Statutes, but the statute never passed the legislature, at least it was omitted, that was supposed to define the scope of discovery. So that currently is an ambiguous situation in Oregon law. Section 4 of the bill would establish a definition, basically the first part of the Federal Rule 26. It doesn't adopt the whole federal rule, doesn't go as far in allowing discovery as the federal rule does, but establishes the basic procedure that's followed by the federal rules in most other states defining the scope of discovery. The Section 3 of the bill also provides a uniform procedure dealing with protection against abuse or hardship in discovery and establishes a uniform provision that would apply to all types of discovery that replaces what is currently ORS 45.181. There's, apart from the fact that the interrogatories are limited to 25, and I should mention, by the way, that there's a memo at the back of my testimony that was prepared by a law student who did extensive research at the request of our committee to look at other state interrogatory provisions to try to find a way to prevent them from being too much of a burden, but yet to achieve the results that are sought to be achieved by having the interrogatory procedure available. One of those results, of course, being the obtaining of testimony and evidence at less cost than depositions. After a study of other states that have limited interrogatories in some way, he set forth this memo that describes the various state procedures, and it was on the basis of this memo that the committee adopted the restriction of limiting it to number, which in section one of this memo, the other states that limit the number are cited for you. There are only a few significant changes between the statute being proposed to you and Federal Rule 33, apart from the limit of 25 as to number. There also is a change in the sanctions provision, the motion to compel procedure, which is discussed in Section 2 of my written testimony here. The federal sanction provision says that attorney's fees shall be awarded. The statute before you changes the shall to a may, so it's only discretionary as to the court to award attorney's fees, and that's only in case where the court finds no substantial basis for the party refusing to respond to the interrogatory or no substantial basis for the moving party to seek a court order to compel discovery. And then the provision of the federal rule that would require parties to supplement their interrogatories with more recent knowledge. That's part of Federal Rule 26. That has also been deleted from the Oregon provision. I would say those are the two most significant substantive changes between the bill before you and Federal Rule 33. I would be pleased to answer any questions any members of the committee may have. I'm deliberately not focusing as much on the substance of the proposal and one of the attorneys that will be testifying in favor of the bill.
Questions? Thank you very much.
While I'm here, if I could, Madam Chairperson, I have a letter from an attorney in Eugene, Darst Atherley, which he asked me to read into the record and distribute on his behalf. He's not able to be here. He has a conflict in California. It's a very brief letter, if I could just read it quickly into the record. Dear Mr. Kirkpatrick, it is my understanding that the appropriate committee will be considering House Bills 2257, 2258, and 2259 on Monday, April 8th. As you know, I had planned to testify on behalf of the Oregon State Bar in favor of these bills, but circumstances beyond my control require my attendance to a matter out of state at the time these bills will come up. The purpose of this letter is to ask you to convey to the Senate committee my support for these bills. Of the three, the one most seriously needed is the one relating to interrogatories. I know there has been much complaint on the part of a very few members of the bar about the possibilities of abuse of interrogatories, and there is no question but that interrogatories have occasionally been abused in the federal system. Of course, the same can be said for practically every procedural device that exists. My belief is, however, that the limitation in the number of interrogatories that can be used as contained in the Oregon bill will make difficult any serious abuses. There are some things that cannot be done with interrogatories that can be done with interrogatories that simply can't be done with any other discovery device. As to a corporate party, interrogatories can be very helpful in establishing what person should be deposed. Sometimes a party can be frustrated or at least put to unreasonable expense simply by the refusal of counsel on the other side to advise who is best equipped to answer questions. In product liability litigation, interrogatories are really the only practical means of determining the kind and number of similar failures of the same product. These are just a couple of examples of the uses to which interrogatories could be put. The list could be greatly extended. In closing, and anticipating the arguments that we have been hearing for at least 15 years, I can't understand what all the fuss is about as to the difficulty in answering interrogatories. Very often, the client can do it with only help as to form. If not that, then an intelligent secretary can handle it with a minimum of assistance. It is a cheap, fast, inexpensive way of getting information without putting any great burden on anyone. Very truly yours, Darst Atherley. Mr. Atherley is an attorney in Eugene that specializes in litigation and is a member of the Procedure and Practice Committee of the Oregon State Bar. Thank you.
Thank you very much. House Bill 3172, Justice Denneke and Judge Schwab.
Way back. Way back. We don't have any space to get it. That's all. As a fair person, if it's agreeable, I would like to have Chief Judge Schwab speak first.
Surely.
You know, this 3172, of course, gives the Supreme Court the power to transfer cases presently within its jurisdiction to the Court of Appeals for the next, I think, for the next 3-year period. Part of this, I think you've already heard in connection with the hearing on SJR 6, Senator Roberts, in her capacity as chairman of the Subcommittee of Ways and Means, in hearing our budget, has heard, and the Supreme Court has heard a good deal of this. I'll try, though, to make sense of it, to give a brief history, and I assume that people won't hesitate to interrupt me if it's repetition. In 1968, the total number of appeals filed in the state of Oregon, all of which went to the Supreme Court because there was no Court of Appeals, numbered 628. Based on those figures, the Supreme Court was getting behind. It was operating with 2 full-time pro tems, in other words, operating as a court of 9 and was sitting in departments in a great many cases. And based on those statistics, the legislature created the Court of Appeals, which came into being in July 1, 1969, same time as Washington and Colorado's Courts of Appeals came into being. The Court of Appeals was a court of 5 judges with partial, not complete, jurisdiction. Essentially public law, criminal, workman's compensation, probate and domestic relations, juvenile, administrative agency in any cases in which public agencies or officers were, state or local, were a party, leaving the essentially private litigation going directly to the Supreme Court. The way that division, based upon the 68 filings, would have meant roughly 325 cases for the Supreme Court and 300 for the Court of Appeals. Well, there's been literally an explosion in the appeals process in Oregon since that time. We had 5 judges and the Supreme Court 7, which was 12 appellate judges, based upon 628 cases, and obviously allowing for some growth. Since that time, the legislature has authorized 1 additional judge on the Court of Appeals. We now have 6 as a total of 13 appellate judges. Well, last year, the Supreme Court's load had grown over the years from 325, roughly, at 68, based upon that division, to 500, I think it was, is that correct? 501, something like that. Court of Appeals load had grown from around 300, projected based on 68, to 1,847. And our filings this year, so far, for the first 3 months, indicate we're going to run around 2,400 appeals in 1977. We budgeted for and requested 2 more Court of Appeals judges to handle our existing jurisdiction to take care of the increase. The bar recommended 3. I think we felt it could be done with 2 based upon our present jurisdiction, and that's the budget that went to Ways and Means.
Now, what's the projected Court of Appeals cases for 77?
2,400, I think. That's based upon the first 3 months and the growth over last year, which was 1,847. I thought it was a little off. It's going the other way. And it's going up in all categories. So at any rate, we anticipated that two would be able to handle the projected load based upon the present existing jurisdiction. The Supreme Court, at the same time, budgeted for two full-time pro tems to take care of its load, which includes a lot of unseen work in terms of dealing with petitions for review. We then asked, and SJR 6 asked that an interim study be made of the ways of handling this load on the basis, I think it was agreed, that it's not good as a long-term idea to have a Supreme Court operating in departments or operating with pro tems. When I appeared before House Judiciary, House Judiciary said, why just the two judges, and why not go, and if this is the situation, why not go for increased jurisdiction, and rather than giving two regular judges to the Court of Appeals and two pro tems to the Supreme Court, go for four judges in the Court of Appeals and allow the Supreme Court to start transferring jurisdiction, moving towards the day when all appeals go to the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court becomes a court of discretionary review only, as is the case in the federal system in most of the larger states. Well, our answer to that was that the bar had not had a chance to consider that and could open the suggestions of, well, why not contact the committees and have them consider it now? And the answer to that was, well, the bar could officially act only based upon resolutions or action taken at its convention, which comes in each year in early October.
Are you going to give us the figures of the projected cases for the Supreme Court in 77?
I'll let Justice Dedeke do that, if I may. I'm not too as familiar with the way their trend has been running.
Could you give me 1968? I'd kind of like to.
68 was a total of 628.
There's something in between here.
All right, so get my statistics out there. Got them year by year. Okay, you want the Court of Appeals?
Right.
1975, 61. 71, 621.
Let's see, this is which year?
71, 621.
621, okay.
72, 764.
764.
73, year by year,
yeah.
841.
841.
74, 1041.
1041.
75, 1538. 76, 1847.
1847.
The first 3 months of this year, we've averaged 200 a month.
What's the main reason for this increase?
Well, Senator, I wish I could tell you. We've got these figures, and they show increases in the number of civil appeals, criminal appeals, comp appeals, administrative agency appeals. It apparently is just, this is a more litigious age.
Well, has there been some change in the law that has caused that?
Well, there have been two changes. One change is, of course, prior to 2 years ago, there was no such thing as a review of disciplinary proceedings in the prisons. There is now, and that gives us 200 or 300 a year, 360 last year, I think. The second change that has not yet had any significant impact is the district court of record, with appeals direct to the Court of Appeals. But that has not had any significant impact on these figures as yet. What the impact will be remains to be seen. But for example, between 76 and 75, civil went from 342 to 421. Criminal from 684 to 735. Comp from 65 to 104. Administrative agency review from 392 to 557. Also, the no-fault divorce or no-fault dissolution of marriage, more properly referred to, is resulting in a great many more trials at the trial court level. And of course, even if the percentage of appeals remains constant, that's more appeals. Also, the fact that all administrative agency hearing, the litigant, the private litigant, gets a free transcript by law, which makes it much cheaper for them to appeal, and we get a great many administrative agency appeals. Legal aid is appealing a lot of unemployment, comp, welfare, and food stamp cases that were almost unheard of in the court system before, because who could afford to appeal them? Who could afford to handle them?
What percentage of the, let's say, the appeals in 1976 were criminal?
Well, I can give you that. Of the 1,847, 421 were purely criminal. 30 were post-conviction habeas corpus. Oh, I'll take that back. I'm sorry. 735 were criminals. 30 were post-conviction or habeas corpus. And 360 were disciplinary review. So you had about 1,100 out of 1,847 that you could say were criminal or quasi-criminal.
Any further questions?
Well, yeah, this thought is, I've discussed this with people and I can't call their names now, but the thought has been suggested that if we're going to increase the number of Court of Appeals judges, rather than just increasing it up to six or eight or whatever it is you want, and giving them this broad jurisdiction, it might make a lot more sense to carve out another intermediate appellate court and a court of criminal appeals, like they have, I think, in some states, and maybe take three judges and let them Court of Criminal Appeals, and then if there's to be any movement back and forth, let it be between the different levels of the Court of Appeals.
Texas, Tennessee, and Oklahoma, I think, have Courts of Criminal Appeals, which are courts of final jurisdiction. I think in all of those jurisdictions, they're trying to get rid of that. That's all I can tell you.
You didn't necessarily mean final, did you?
No, I didn't mean final. I meant as an intermediate level. In other words, rather than, what would you think of the idea, in terms of judge time,
mm-hmm.
Court of Appeals judge time, we have out of 1,847 cases, 1,100
mm-hmm.
about were criminal type cases. That's not quite two-thirds, but it's awful close. What would you say the allocation in terms of time that it takes to handle these cases is between the criminal-type appeals and the civil-type appeals?
Oh, my guess is that probably the criminal-type take 40 to 50%. Maybe closer to 40%.
Of the total time?
Of the total time. You see, statistics, we obviously, if all these cases were the same type of difficulty you had traditionally when people didn't appeal cases unless they were important, unless they really thought they had something, we obviously couldn't have increased our capacity to handle cases from 60 cases per judge to 300 per judge. The fact is, the disciplinary review cases, of which there are 360, don't take very much time. Very few cases of those in which we write opinions. In criminal cases, we get a lot of what we refer to as Anders appeals. Anders versus California's United States Supreme Court case that says that an indigent criminal defendant has got to have the same rights to appeal at government expense that a private litigant with money would have. A lot of those are pro forma appeals. They don't amount to anything. On the other hand, some of them are extraordinarily, at least we think, difficult. So I'd say the criminal probably is closer, between 40 and 50%. My offhand guess is 40. Zoning cases, land use cases, something almost unheard of up until 3 years ago. Our court has written more land use opinions since Fasano 3 years ago than were written in the entire history of the state of Oregon up until that time. Those cases eat up a great deal of time. I don't know if that's a response to
the question. All right, now let's see. There are now six Court of Appeals judges, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And you're asking, somewhere along the road, somewhere in here, you've asked that it be increased from six to eight?
That's correct.
And you see,
we've asked for an increase from six to eight. The Supreme Court has asked, in effect, for an increase from seven to nine by the use of two pro tem judges. There's one of three ways that this kind of load growth has been handled in the United States. One of them would be to increase the Supreme Court permanent membership to nine. I think Washington has done that. I think Minnesota has done that. It hasn't worked out very well in either case, but I'll let Judge Denneke obviously can speak to that better than I can. Although I sat for a year on the Supreme Court as a pro temp when it was operating as a nine-man court, and you get so busy reading the other fellow's opinions, anything beyond three reduces productivity in terms of efficiency and still having a collegiate court. That's one way. The other way is to make a Court of Appeals a court of final jurisdiction, as Texas, Oklahoma, and Tennessee have done in criminal law matters. Apparently, it has not worked out to their satisfaction. You end up with two rules of evidence and two of every procedures, the whole works. The third way is to do what most of the more populous states have done, including Colorado now, which started out with partial jurisdiction as we have, and that's to make a Court of Appeals the court to which all direct appeals go, and the Supreme Court a court of discretionary review, the one more or less a case decided court, the other a law stating court, if you, for want of a better phrase. Those are the choices, I think. There may be some others, but I haven't heard of them. As I say, we asked, the Court of Appeals asked for two judges. The Supreme Court asked for this interim study. The House Judiciary said, why the study? It's inevitable. Let's start doing it now. That's this bill.
Sure.
Senator Smith.
How many cases and in what other subjects that workman's comp, in which I'm familiar, are there appeals through the appeals court to the Supreme Court? The
Supreme Court can grant review on any case that we have. Last year,
43.
Last year it granted review in 43. I forget how many were.
Is that workman's comp?
No, all comp. All it granted, I think, not more than one workman's comp.
So really, that's not a contributor to the problem.
Of ours?
It's a small contributor.
To our problem?
To the total problem.
Again, I don't know. I think he can answer it better than I, but they granted 43, but the petitions for review were 467. Just as much time, perhaps more, is spent on the petitions which are denied, and those are at least as much in determining whether to grant them or to deny them. So a lot of that work is unseen, but
I'm trying to get at the question.
May I interrupt? Workman's comp cases have not been any problem as far as the Supreme Court, as far as Biden is concerned.
Now, go ahead.
I was just going to say, but obviously going from 65 to 103 in 1 year is a coming thing in the Court of Appeals.
Well, you see, if I can be philosophical for just a minute, there's several ways of dealing with appeals. One is to eliminate them. I mean, you can go to the extreme of eliminating them. There is no constitutional right to an appeal, but I think everybody agrees that the American system is at least one trial on the facts and one appeal for error. And the minute you grant an appeal to anybody that can afford the appeal, and then certainly in the criminal field, and in the, I think in the juvenile field also, you've got to grant the appeal at state expense to he who can't afford it. Now, if appeal is considered really to be a matter of right, which it currently is under Oregon statutes, should you control it by making it artificially expensive? Up until 1969, all briefs had to be printed. Reply briefs were required. It was pretty expensive. We eliminated that. We provided for Xerox, photocopying, typing, and the long carbon copies if they were legible. That eliminated a lot of expense. It made appeals cheaper. That, in a sense, encourages appeals. The business of furnishing free transcripts in the administrative agency cases, which was a decision made by this legislator at the time the legislature, at the time the APA was adopted, has made it very much easier to appeal. It's a question of, should the philosophy be make it as simple as is possible and still efficient, or to create some barriers which discourage? We've opted, I think, and generally, I think that's been the spirit of legislation, to not create artificial barriers in terms of our unnecessary expenses. It certainly mushrooms the appeal, so it may be one of the reasons.
Senator Cook.
Is John Denneke now going to testify additionally, or do I need to ask questions from you, Judge, in order to find out what I'm interested in?
I intended to talk on the Supreme Court statistics.
Okay.
Bye. Senator Carson.
Well, I guess I just want to know, Senator Smith was concerned about workman's comp and the role they played. Obviously, they don't play a very, 43 or 7, they don't play a great role in the Supreme Court, but when he, I was, the increase, from, if I recall the statistics correctly, 63 to 103 in a one-year period of time, and we're also tinkering now, and it relates directly to this, of eliminating the circuit court from workman's comp so they'd appeal directly from the workman's comp board to the court of appeals. I was trying to get a handle on, granted 103 is not a big part of 2400 or of 1847, whatever you had last time, but our workman's comp isn't going to go away.
No, nor is the administrative agency, which went from 392 to 557. An administrative review includes a land use LCDC, and we're just starting to get the impact.
So workman's comp is important, but on a scale of other things.
On a scale of other, everything is gone up. In the 1 year, civil 342 to 421, criminal 684, 735, comp, I've given you administrative review. The only thing that hasn't gone up is post-conviction and habeas corpus, which speaks well for the Post-Conviction Act Oregon adopted some 8 years ago. It's about wiped out that problem.
Justice
Kennedy?
Thank you. I may sound like a broken record because I appeared before this committee in favoring a resolution to set up a study commission on this same subject, but events are moving faster.
Could I just interrupt? I believe that's SJR 10,
right.
And SJR 6.
Right.
Six
right.
Seems to be, it was 3.8. Right. You always get me up out of my chair. Right? I think it's 10.
SJR 10.
Still looking for
six. Our statistics are very simple. In 1970, that was the first year that the Court of Appeals was established. There were 300 appeals filed in our court. Looking back at it now, I wonder how I occupied my time. I seemed to be busy at the time, but that didn't last long. In 1 year, they jumped to 380.
That was 72.
In 71, they jumped to 380. In 70, the first school year operating at the Court of Appeals, they were down to 300 in the Supreme Court. And now,
okay, well, could you run right through those years up to now, Farmer?
Sure. 70 in the first, well, that's the year we
checked. I got that, and I got
300. 71, 381, 72, 374, 73, 365, then they start going up again. 74, 412, 75, 475, 472, and 76, 549. Now, one warning on those figures, they include cases in which we granted a petition for review. In other words, they include both filings and those in which we granted petitions for review, so we had to write an opinion and issue a decision on it.
And what's your projection for 77?
Well, fortunately, 77, based on the first 3 months, is going to stay the same. At least all I can say is the first 3 months have stayed the same, which is a welcome relief.
Which would be 549 would be your projection
mm-hmm.
for 77.
Right. In 76, the seven regular judges issued opinions in 280 cases, an average of 40 cases. That's the best we've ever done. I don't know whether we can duplicate it. I can't duplicate my effort of last year, I know. This was partly due to we've got a very talented woman as a career law clerk. But I don't think we can write over 280 cases, the regular judges. Yet, based upon the filings of last year and the usual rate of dismissal that we can check throughout the years, we've got 373 cases that are going, based upon the cases filed last year, that are going to require opinions. So we're just about 100 cases over the number of cases that our regular judges can write. So we started in the first of the year, we started in using two circuit judges pro tem. We've used Judge O'Connell as a senior appellate judge for a couple of months, and then we're going to go back to using circuit judges. But I think the basic statistic is we have about 100 more cases now in which, based upon last year's filings, in which opinions are going to have to be written, 100 more than the regular judges can write if they hit their highest peak. And the Supreme Court unanimously have no objection to the bill that's being considered. I'm putting it the way I am, have no objection, because of what Chief Judge Schwab partly alluded to. We went to the bar and said, we need a study commission. We're going to ask the legislature for a study commission. We're sure that they'll let you have some input into it. Then House Judiciary started and went ahead with this bill to permit us to transfer jurisdiction. We're convinced that that ultimately is the solution that's going to be recommended by any study commission. But we don't want to be in the position of breaking faith with the bar by coming out here strongly and saying 3172 is the only way to go. Now, maybe you think I'm pussyfooting, and maybe I am here, but certainly none of the members of the court have any objection to this, and as I say, think that this is ultimately the solution that any study commission is going to have to come forth with.
Item 7.
Senator Cook.
Now, let's see. If this were to pass, what's the companion legislation? The Court of Appeals is going from 6 to 8?
Would to be of any use, Senator, I think it would have to be from 6 to 10. And fiscally, there should be very little impact because we hopefully will have two pro tems regularly to operate with the accompanying secretaries and law clerks and so forth. So Senator Roberts, I think, knows the figures better than I do, but as I recall, it's pretty much the same, whether there are two more judges added to the Court of Appeals or we operate with two full-time pro tems.
All right, now, what is the, in breakdown, what kinds of cases are those now that you, to which there is an original right of appeal to the Supreme Court?
I have to do it by exclusion, but the Court of Appeals has criminal, those cases in which the state or any subdivision of state local government is a party, probate, domestic relations. Everything else, automobile cases, land fraud cases, fall into our court. Did I skip any big categories?
Juvenile
is in the Court of Appeals.
I'd say essentially, the Supreme Court gets direct appeal of all purely private litigation and we get all public or quasi-public.
Well, just as one person's opinion, I don't really see that the increase in the Supreme Court load has been all that big by your figures here. And what category? One way to, if you were going to say recommend a category of case that the Oregon Supreme Court is now handling as a matter of first right of appeal, if you were going to try to reduce the
burden of cases in that manner, which category of cases would you suggest that be added to the Court of Appeals then?
We haven't really zeroed in on this problem yet, but in talking about it, we want to have some categories where there's no, they're pretty well defined. One category that suggested itself is the equity appeals, and the reason for that is that those are the appeals where they're de novo, and the appellate court goes over the record and is free to make their own findings of fact.
And what portion of the total number of cases?
I don't know. I've never checked that out. One other category, and I hesitate to state this, seeing particularly some of the people who are in the back of the room there, is but has been suggested is automobile cases. Now the reason the Court of Appeals was got the jurisdiction they did in 1969 is the automobile tort lawyers were a strong enough force, and they didn't want it to go to the Court of Appeals, so it stayed in the Supreme Court. And they still are a fairly effective force.
All right, now what's the problem, if any, of increasing the Supreme Court from 7 to 9?
Well, as Judge Schwab said, in the first place, it means that you have more opinions to read of other judges, and that is a large part of a judge's job. It should be, because they're the opinions of the court, not just of the judge that writes the opinion. The second thing is, under our present jurisdiction, we're getting a lot of cases that are important to the litigants. All cases are important to the litigants, but they really aren't important to the jurisprudence of the state or that the public has a great deal of interest in. For example, you'd be surprised, I think we get about 2 cases of adverse possession a month where somebody's fighting over 2 yards or not a very large tract of property and not a very valuable piece of property, but those are the kind of things they litigate. Now, I don't think 9 people should be involved in this kind of litigation. If we start splitting into departments, as we have now, we're working in departments of 4, then pretty soon we run into cases where there's a split in the court, we have to set them down for free argument again, which is an inefficient way to run it. I've never, when we operate as we are now with 9 people, with 2 pro tems, but the pro tems do not sit on the cases that we consider of statewide importance and the cases that we set down in bank and not in department.
But if you're operating by departments now, and what numbers of, what percentage of all the cases the Supreme Court considers are considered by department?
Now about 60%.
How would that materially change if you had 9 and still operated by departments? You still would have, you could operate with departments of 4 and 5, I presume.
We might very well operate, well, I don't know.
Or 3.
Or we have operated before the Court of Appeals came along. We operated sometimes in departments of 3. Really, it's unsatisfactory principally in department, because some judges, if they had sat in the department, would have decided the case differently, and the next time that point comes up, they will vote differently. And so you don't get a decision, a final decision of the highest court in the state when you sit in departments.
Because you don't get decisions of the highest courts in the state when the Court of Appeals does it either, and you don't consider it.
Well, we always consider it. Now, the fact that we don't to grant the petition, you're correct that we don't in that instance. But each one of their, well, whenever a petition for review is filed, of course, then we consider it. And I should have added, one part of our work that's, of course, it didn't exist before the Court of Appeals is the petitions for review. That's become increasingly a large part of our work. There were 467 last year, and that means that there are 467 matters in which the whole court has to take a position and vote one way or another. Sometimes they're easy, but sometimes they're very difficult.
Now, Judge, what's your idea towards the possibility of an intermediate criminal court?
Well, my only knowledge is at the time that the Court of Appeals was established, this was something that was considered, having a separate Court of Criminal Appeals. I didn't know much about it, except that the experience of Oklahoma and Texas, and I'd forgotten about Tennessee, was studied, and apparently it was not satisfactory. However, as someone pointed out, in those states there are final Court of Final Appeals.
Very one thing on that. Actually, we for all practical purposes, sit in only departments of three. They're constantly rotating. I don't split the three into three here and three here, but constantly rotating so that there are no fixed departments. But we don't hear more than two cases a year in bank. We never hear a case initially in bank. We hear them in departments of three, so in that sense, that's what we're doing now.
Senator Carson.
This is not intended as a criticism of either court or the Oregon State Bar, but I guess it's criticism of our counterpart on the other west end of the building. I admit to some confusion on where we're going and where we've been and where we ought to go, but it seems to me that we're doing a typical legislative step backward by passing 5172 and some form of other bills, including pro tem, and then by 3172, giving the Supreme Court the authority to select things. In other words, we're saying indirectly, it's a three cushion shot, is what it means to me. And why don't we just, is it the political nature of it? If the intent is, if I understand it, to increase, for all practical purposes, the Court of Appeals to 10, why don't we take that jump now?
Well, that's what would happen. Maybe I didn't make myself clear. We asked the two judges for our court, for our current jurisdiction. That's for the Court of Appeals. Supreme Court came in with its budget asking for 9 judges, 2 pro tems. The House Judiciary, along with this bill, there's a companion bill, I shouldn't mention that, says, no, pass this bill, give the Court of Appeals 4 judges, take away the money for pro tems from the Supreme Court. In other words, put 4 judges in the Court of Appeals and no additional judges in the Supreme Court rather than 2 and 2.
Well, I heard that's coming, but
that's sitting in Senator Brown's, or Senator Roberts' subcommittee.
In the relatively short time I've been here, I've seen 2 companion bills go 2 different directions, 1 pass and 1 not, and the result is you have an incredible mishmash.
Well, what would happen, Senator, as far as I'm concerned, we need the 2 judges to carry our current jurisdiction. Whether or not we should take on more jurisdiction, I really think in policy matters, a policy matter for the legislature and the Supreme Court, not for the Court of Appeals. But if this bill passes, and then we only get the 2 judges, I would, for want of a better term, scream very loudly if they had the Supreme Court attempted to give us any additional jurisdiction, I'm sure it would not.
Okay, in other words, what we're saying, in my anger, is certainly not at the present members nor the chairman of the subcommittee. It's a typical way of getting around Ways and Means Committee. You go all over the ballpark depending on what Ways and Means is going to ultimately do. Is that not
true? No. Senator Roberts.
What we've been doing down there with their budgets is waiting for this bill so that the House and the Senate can make a policy decision on this. If this then passes the Senate, we've got our directive.
But my
if it does not pass the Senate, then we can't just sit there and hold that budget. We've got to do something with the budget.
My point is, Madam Chairman, and that's I appreciate the help on that. That's precisely my point, is that when the Senate passes this bill, what has it passed? Is it passed 4 in the Circuit in the Court of Appeals? Has it passed 2 in the Supreme Court? And what has it passed? And I think what we'll wind up is another budget note. We'll say the Senate has passed this, meaning that, whatever Ways and Means wants it.
What the subcommittee is doing is listening to these 2 people tell us exactly what they've told you today.
Yes.
That if this bill passes, they went forward in the appellate court.
Well, they've told me several things. First of all, they've told me that if they could get 4 in the Court of Appeals, they would give all jurisdiction to the Court of Appeals.
Excuse me, I don't think we could transfer all. See, that
even
would,
with 4.
Well, that makes us look pretty bad. That means that 2 of those people are doing what 7 of us are supposed to be doing. So that, but and I, aside from how it makes us look, I don't think the thought was to transfer all jurisdiction with 2 more.
Oh, okay, I misperceive. Maybe you've answered this. What would you send down there?
Well, I think we would send the categories after some trial and error, see how much they could handle.
With 10.
May I if I may, along with Senator Roberts, it's my understanding, well, Senator Roberts voiced it there, is that if the legislature authorizes or passes 3172, and if it authorizes four judges for the Court of Appeals, why then our request for pro tem judges is gone. I mean, we have no no need for pro tem judges.
Is that what you're, could I ask Senator Brown, Senator Roberts, is that what she means by saying we passed 3172, that means the Senate says we want to beef up the Court of Appeals and not beef up the Supreme Court?
Right. That's the way we interpret it. Now, you know, everybody fusses about the ways and means.
Well, not everybody. Just
few of us. Just you. making the policy. And when they've talked to us about this is what they would like to do, it is obvious we could take their budgets and do it. But instead, it seems that we there believe that the legislature, the House, the floor of the House, the floor of the Senate, should make the decision.
Okay, and somebody's going to explain to them that when they vote aye on 3172, what they're really voting aye on is some message to Ways and Means not to increase the Supreme Court,
that's
but
right.
to add four to the Court of Appeals. And that's
right.
all in 3172.
That's right.
Well, sure. Well, there's a separate bill for the four judges
no,
to the Court of Appeals.
There's no purpose in 3172 if we're trying to telegraph messages to our bill makers, policy makers, that I've got to know what it is when I vote 3172. Chief Judge Schwab's and deprive you of two pro tems.
Madam Chairman, there's some
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Getting back to the bill, what kind of public policy is it to allow really you two gentlemen to sit down for breakfast and decide which cases may be heard before you? Is that what we want to be doing? Or should we be getting at the point, the argument, the discussion about whether how many people you need, Judge Ron, and how many people you need?
The point is, I think, and that's why you see in that bill, as it came to you, an expiration date
of 3 years.
That's right. And the reason for that expiration date was just that. That we suggested to the committee that if they were going to go on this idea, they should not make it an open-ended thing, because in the long run, it was not proper for the courts to decide jurisdiction, it was for the legislature. We don't know how many judges, if we're going to have our jurisdiction increased. Colorado uses 12 Jewish conferences. Colorado is about the size of the city. We don't know whether we can do it with 10. 10 is enough. Or 11, or it will also take 12. We do know that once you get new judges, it's pretty difficult to eliminate those positions. And this is an interim measure to, for what it's worth, your idea, to allow, see how much of that load they can handle. And then we can come back 2 years from now, say the damn thing doesn't work, it'll expire, or transfer this jurisdiction.
We could have the same question if you got two judges and the Supreme Court had the opportunity for two pro tems. You could get out the same workload problem you're getting at in this bill. Is that correct?
You could deal with the same, theoretically, I think you could deal with the same workload.
And if you followed this with a study, which you also testified in favor of, which would give you an opportunity to study the question of transfer and what it's to transfer these cases, and also the jurisdiction of these questions. You follow with that study, and by the next legislative session, we have a little clearer idea which direction to go, at least some information. The bar would have had an opportunity to discuss it. And it seems like a lot clearer way to go to me, or maybe I'm missing something.
That was the basis of SJR 10 in the first place, was to ask for the study. The House's reaction was there was only one possible way to go, and this is it.
Well, I think, Madam Chairman,
but whether that's and based upon the, well, maybe you can answer that better.
Well, Senator Smith, either way is perfectly feasible. as I see it, the better part of this way is we don't know, and I'm speaking we, Judge Schwab and I and our courts, we don't know, under the methods that the Court of Appeals use, how many cases of the kind that we are now getting can be processed by two more judges. They handle things, I don't think there's any secret, in a much more summary way. They decide 25% of the cases right from the bench at the end of oral argument. Our judges would shake at that procedure. But we don't know, and this way would give us an opportunity to see how many cases and what kinds of cases two more judges on that court could handle. Now, I am sure that they'll handle more than two judges on our court under our present system handle.
Well, I don't know whether we lose anything by you two gentlemen determining jurisdiction. I would assume that, you know, if you floated it out to the we common folk, they would probably wonder what the hell is going on in this house.
No. Senator Robbins?
Why, again, asked and suggested that limitation. I think you're correct. It's a permanent matter. It would be very good.
Are there further questions?
Yes. Senator Cook. One last one. I've been in all kinds of newspaper conflicting. Have you accepted jurisdiction of the Hermiston case?
We have not passed on the petition for review yet. We had all sorts of amicus curiae briefs. They're all in now.
How soon are you going to decide that?
Well, really, aren't
we? We realize it's one of our
further questions.
Before the session is over, I hope.
Hopefully.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Back to House Bill 2257. Austin Crowe.
Determines whether the State Public Employees Relations Act.
Oh, that one.
And supersedes home rule.
Madam Chairman, Austin Crowe, member of the Oregon State Bar. I was the past president of the Practice and Procedure Committee and was here before this committee 2 years ago on these bills. And as Mr. Kirkpatrick states, I don't remember exactly how many years we've been before the legislature with this particular bill or this package of bills, but I think that at this time it's very important for me just briefly to say to you that it's somewhat ironical that over the years, every 2 years, the Bar Association committees get together and decide this is something that we should do. We go before the annual convention of the Bar, and last year there was a very vigorous dispute and argument about it, but the convention again voted to pass this bill. And here we are. It's already been through the House, and we're here at the Senate again, just about where we were 2 years ago, and we almost had the bill out of this committee, but at the last minute, some members of the Bar come down and they use their very very good abilities to talk and say that this is something not to do. And I have to be...
I understood the judges to say, maybe I wasn't listening to your presentation.
No, we're not on that bill. We're on 257.
Which one are you on, huh?
No, 257. We changed to the interrogatory.
I can read the bird.
You mean they came down here and used a bunch of lawyers' arguments?
Well, no. What happens is experienced members in both the plaintiff's bar and the defense bar come down here and say, look, we don't want to have any additional discovery because, we don't think it helps us in handling our cases. And if you're a very experienced lawyer and you know just what to do, you prefer not to have the other side get as much information as they can. And I think in the past what we've tried to say is that we think it's fairer for all litigants, whether you're an experienced trial lawyer or not, to have available to you tools to get certain information in your case. And my own personal interest relates more to the question of the new young lawyers that are coming out today, because if you're adding 400 or 500 lawyers every year, and you're having a large number of increases in cases, what you need to do is you need to provide them with tools so that they can know what to do and get answers to their questions. I'm particularly interested in reducing the amount of malpractice as far as lawyers are concerned, and that's one of my own personal interests, but I think in my role working on the Practice and Procedure Committee over the last few years, up until last year, I've seen that it actually benefits many lawyers to have these tools available to you, and I think that we get down to the philosophical question. Do we want to go back to the old adversary system where everybody goes into the courthouse, nobody knows too much about what the other fellow is doing, and if you happen to be a very talented lawyer and you can pull a few surprises on the other side, you're going to win? I think we've passed that stage, and I think that now we've recognized that the best thing to do as far as getting the best results in the trial courts is to provide everybody with the information that they have before you go in. And why do I say this? Well, first of all, if everybody knows the facts in the beginning, and whether it's the defense lawyer knowing about the prior history and medical problems of the plaintiff, or whether it's the plaintiff's lawyer finding out all the things that the defendant did in the past that he maybe wasn't able to find by deposition, or he wasn't able to find the corporate things that are hidden back in some computer somewhere, everybody's going to know more. You're going to get better results, you're going to get more settlements, and sitting back there and listening to the two judges speak, you're going to get fewer appeals, because you're going to have fewer lawyers shocked by the result. Maybe they don't think it's fair and wanting to appeal the case. So I think whether you're talking about interrogatories or whether you're talking about increasing the discovery, basically what we're trying to do is to make available to all the lawyers in the state tools so that they can find out the facts of their case without having to go to expensive depositions, traveling all across the country to find out what the facts are. I think it's interesting that many lawyers say, well, it increases the cost if you have interrogatories. Well, I think the simple answer to that is, if you're limited to 25, you're not going to increase the cost that much. But ironically, if you can remember, Senator Crook particularly, and Senator Carson too, 2 years ago, the people that came in here and were advocating to have this were lawyers who represented poor people, who said, we don't want all the costs of depositions and discoveries in simple cases. If we can ask a short number of questions and get all our information and just use the secretary to do it, it's going to produce more efficient functioning of our system. Now, many of the lawyers that come, whether they be the plaintiff's lawyer or the defendant's lawyer, who's an experienced trial lawyer, comes in and says, we don't like the additional cost of this. But stop and think about it. How many lawyers who have lots of plaintiff's cases, and I won't use any particular names, love to go to the state court when they don't want the defense lawyer to find out all the facts about the case? But as soon as they get a Siemens case, they want to go to the federal court so they can use all the discovery tools there to find out about the Panamanian shipping company or the Korean shipping company. And I think that there is an ability to go back and forth between the courts depending on your particular case. And I think that when the majority of the states in this country have a discovery system that provides you with access to information rather than preventing you from getting it, I think that we should finally go to that point. I think we should provide these minimal discovery techniques with the safeguards that are there. And I think that when you stop and think about it, if the Bar Association, both in committee and in their annual meeting, comes down to the legislature every year and says it, I think you should take into consideration that the personal viewpoints of lawyers who don't like these things may be absolutely honest and candid in their opinion. And maybe it's something that's personally advantageous to them. But I think that the important thing is that the Bar as a whole is in favor of doing this. And it is what I'm concerned with, that you provide information so that we minimize malpractice, increase the information, increase the number of settlements, reduce the number of appeals. And I think when you look at the package of these bills, whether they talk about requests for admissions, whether they talk about additional discovery materials, or they talk about written interrogatories as a supplement to depositions, you can see that that's what we're trying to do. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much. William Martin.
Thank you. He's getting quite experienced on some of these bills.
My name is William C. Martin. I'm Vice Chairman of the Procedure and Practice Committee. I'm an attorney from Portland, Oregon, a member of the Oregon State Bar, testifying for the Oregon State Bar. The arguments are made in regard to House Bill 2257 that lawyers don't know how to try cases, and given the right to use interrogatories, they'll burden themselves, the clients, and the courts. And it's been testified, I think, by some in the House committee that interrogatories would be of value only in one of 100 cases. If that is true, this would say very little for the intelligence or the quality of the Oregon Bar. I don't believe that the majority of lawyers who voted for this legislation the Oregon State Bar Convention are in agreement with that. Most states do permit written interrogatories, and their use in those states and is not being diminished. The greatest criticism seems to be that interrogatories are used too much, as they are claimed to be used in federal court. This hardly seems to justify the claim that they should not be used at all. The information that is obtained in interrogatories either has to be obtained that way, somewhere else, or not at all. Now, the somewhere else, of course, would be normally in the deposition. I tried cases in the district court for about 5 years. I saw Judge Swab here. I worked for him and tried cases in the district court for about 5 years. and I was trying three or four cases there a week. I'd never remember ever taking a deposition. Obviously, the amount didn't justify it. There were numerous cases there where I could have used interrogatories, and they would have been very valuable. And when we were talking about small cases, frequently we were talking about small people, or people who don't have a lot of money, people who can't afford to pay lawyers, people who can't afford court reporters, can't afford the time and effort involved in arranging depositions when two lawyers can get together and they have to meet, and one of them maybe not doesn't show up, and everybody knows the problem because a good many or most of you people are lawyers anyway. But these are the problems where when you're dealing with interrogatories and when you're limiting the number to 25, I don't think you're giving an abuse to anything, and you're giving an opportunity to get some information that can't be obtained elsewhere. There are also the cases where you don't get cooperation from one from the other side when you ask them a question. You call up and say, who would I ask to find out who had charge of the quality control or something of that kind. There are our lawyers and there are clients. It isn't always the lawyer's fault. The client will say, we don't want you to tell them anything. You make them find it out. And lawyers will respond to that by obliging. Interrogatories solve those problems. And I don't think anyone could disagree that to find particular people or particular areas or where you can, say, start taking a deposition, interrogatories can be extremely valuable. Again, as I say, there are a minority, obviously, who do oppose this. I think it has to be conceded it is a minority. Certainly the majority of the bar favors it. They have favored it for some time. And I think it would be very useful, and I think the denial of it denies to some of the people who can't afford the most expensive technique information that can be obtained by a very inexpensive one.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Cook.
Where did the number 25 come from?
You're asking me where 25 comes from. That was determined by the committee. I was on the committee when we determined to take 25. There are five states that limit the number of depositions. The average of the states of the number that it's limited to is 30. There's one state, I believe it's Kansas, that bases it on amount. And 25 was just determined to be an amount small enough that it wasn't going to be burdensome, but extensive enough that getting basic, simple information could be obtained in the 25, and that generally is an average that other states have used.
I gather then they say the court can then, after 25, allow more. How would you anticipate that that would work?
You would have to go to the court and ask to take more, and showing that it was justified.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Bruce Sampson.
My name is Bruce Sampson. I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar, a member of the Procedures and Practice Committee. I have practiced both in state court and in federal court, and I'm speaking in behalf of this House Bill 2257. I think there are two reasons that I feel, based on my experience in the practice, that this is a good bill. The first is that it is simply an additional tool in discovery, an additional way to get at the truth. And therefore, it tends to, because you do get at the truth more quickly and more easily, it tends to promote a more economical and quicker settlement of lawsuits. The second reason is basically economics itself. Maybe an example of some litigation that I handled recently would explain this. At the present time, the only discovery right that we have, there are two discovery rights. We can ask for documents that the other side might have, or we can take depositions. And taking depositions is a very expensive process. And yet, really, when you're getting at the facts in circuit court, in state court, this is the primary method of discovery. It involves the other side's attorney. It involves the time of the witness. It involves any of the other parties and their attorneys. And it can very easily pile up hundreds of dollars worth of attorney's fees for all of the parties involved to go through this deposition process. In addition, sometimes, and the particular case I'm thinking about, involves extensive travel. Because where, for example, someone ships into Oregon, as happened in the case that I dealt with, someone ships into Oregon a defective product from the state of Washington, then in order to depose the witnesses that manufactured that product, you have to travel to Washington. And this involves your travel time, the travel time of your party and the other side's attorneys. Whereas if you had depositions, in many cases, and particularly in the case that I was dealing with, this could have been handled through depositions without going to Washington and taking depositions in Seattle. And I think this type of situation comes up very often, and this type of very limited interrogatories would certainly facilitate the economics of lawsuits to the parties themselves.
Okay.
Senator Smith.
What would you think about making this apply to intrastate legal matters?
Limiting it to intrastate legal matters? Well, I think that would defeat the purpose of it. I think you'd want it to apply to all matters in which the Oregon court had jurisdiction, so that it would, you wouldn't have to, you know, I think it would apply to all matters if the Oregon court had jurisdiction.
Further questions? Senator Wires.
Do you think it would create less trauma for the parties to a suit to be able to use interrogatories rather than having to appear, be questioned under oath?
Well, I think it would, I don't know if trauma is the right word, because I don't think that you could prevent the other side from taking depositions of the parties, but certainly less expense. And if the interrogatories answered the questions that were asked and it wasn't necessary to go into depositions, then I suppose, yes, it would lessen the burden or the trauma, if you will, on litigants.
Having been deposed in a situation where interrogatories probably would have gotten the other side what they wanted, it made me think of that.
Senator Carson?
I was just going to add, I have an elderly client that the interrogatories would have been much superior to a 5-minute deposition. Because you only have 2 questions to ask, but would be.
Further questions?
Okay.
Senator Roberts.
I just want to say that I'm glad to see Bruce here. It's been a long time since I've seen you since he was a little kid. Where are you practicing, Bruce?
You were a young man yourself.
Thank you very much, Bruce. You played with my kids and my grandkids.
He's now a Marbell. He's now Ma Bell.
He's now,
Yeah, I didn't want to prejudice my...
Hello.
Gary Rogers.
I think that's me with Doug Minson's handwriting. Right. The record, I'm Gary Roberts, Deputy Director of Multnomah County Legal Aid.
Good drive.
I'll just be very, very brief. From our standpoint of legal aid, we see a great need for interrogatories. We simply cannot afford depositions, and yet we have many matters where some discovery is certainly, if not essential, very, very helpful in trying a case in the fashion that we would like to try cases, and that is in a lawyer-like, skilled fashion. We can't afford depositions, but interrogatories can be much, much quicker and get us at least a threshold information that would be very helpful in trying. Secondly, in those few cases where we can justify, in view of our meager budget, taking depositions, those depositions can be shortened by the use of interrogatories to obtain information about basic, you know, records and things that aren't answered very quickly by just straight face-to-face questions and answers, but can be answered by referral to records. Finding out questions like who has knowledge about other about evidence and records and stuff like that can all be done by interrogatories. So from our point of view, 2257 is a very necessary, needed, very helpful for our clients.
Thank you very much. Tom Cooney.
One way or another.
My name is Tom Cooney. I'm an attorney, primarily a defense attorney. Although I represent insurance companies and the medical society, I appear here on my own behalf, not representing any individual class.
Now, Chairman, before he begins, it was my information that after the last session, Mr. Cooney made a statement that never, ever would he attend another legislative session for any reason. And I see, Mr. Cooney, I wonder why he's changed your mind.
Time heals all wounds.
Were you wounded at the last session?
It was just an ordeal.
He's only temporarily.
Yeah. That's a good reason for no annual session.
I wish to speak in opposition to 2257. I've tried this law 21 years now. And every 2 years, I have seen this bill for interrogatories attempted to be introduced and passed. There's a substantial split among the lawyers in the state. I think you have to be careful, though, when it is represented that the Oregon State Bar, per se, is in favor of this or that. I think we all know the committee system. The committee that reviewed this had a strong dissent, led by Burl Green, one of the best plaintiff's trial lawyers in the state. The convention system is used. We don't have all that many lawyers appearing at those when they vote. Many of the lawyers that appear at those are not trial lawyers who are actually using these. It is frequently characterized that those that oppose the use of interrogatories are against truth or against knowledge or against free disclosure, and I think that's completely unfair. In litigation that I handle, I always tell the other side, if you want something, let me know what it is and I'll provide it for you. And therefore, to hide behind the absence of interrogatories is no great benefit to me because I don't use that form of device. My concern is the lawyers are pricing themselves beyond the right of the public to afford it. And you can sit back and argue and talk in theory about how inexpensive interrogatories should be. The fact of the matter is they are not. They are time-consuming and they're expensive. The legal aid lawyers say, well, our poor people, we need this. They forget that on the other side, there is someone paying a lawyer to answer those interrogatories. We can respond on the defense side and have the state lawyers spend all that time answering them. There are some instances where you can come up with a particular case and say, yes, that an interrogatory would be helpful in a particular case. But you'll find that the use of interrogatories is what the federal court has deteriorated to, and that is the contest of the art of legal writing. And it becomes contests between lawyers as to how to ask questions, how to avoid answering them. If you think of the expense to the public, you know, they're paying us $50 to $75 an hour, the time that it takes to respond to interrogatories, and I went through and counted the number of possible hearings that this bill, in the guise of being a time-saving device, could put you through, and I count 10 court appearances where we could come in, or the other side could come in, and argue or resist over something that isn't necessary. Now, we've had the two courts existing side by side for years, the federal system and the state system. The state courts are quicker, they're more efficient, they're less expensive than the federal practice. I've talked to Judge Olson and Judge Dale, and they feel strongly that part of the reason why we have fallen behind in the state court recently is because we've adopted cross claims and some other federal procedures. And I think if you stop and think of the dollar expense that you're putting people to when the thing has existed for so long without the need for it, you're putting a tremendous burden on the public. Now, I'm the member of a large firm, and I can afford to hire young people to write those things and answer them. But someday I have to go to my client and say, here's the bill. And consistently through the years, the cost of handling litigation in the federal court as opposed to the state court runs about one-third more because of the so-called time-saving devices. And I ask you to consider that for 20 years this battle has raged, and there's been a reason why it hasn't been done. And it's even more important now when we come to the time of the cost, where lawyers are becoming too expensive to have anything handled. And I don't dispute the fact that you may find one or two cases, but I ask you to weigh the fact that that expense is always going to be there. Now, it's suggested that this may be a way to eliminate malpractice. On the contrary, the malpractice spectrum will be a reason why the lawyer must use interrogatories. You will have to take interrogatories to protect yourself from being guilty of malpractice, because it was a tool that was there for discovery. You didn't use it, you lost the case, and you're wide open for a malpractice claim. The taking of interrogatories does not eliminate the need for depositions. You almost always end up with both of them. Now, it's true that by trying to eliminate them, we're limiting to 25, you may get away from some of the horrendous tragedies we've seen in the federal court. But all it takes is two questions such as this. What are the legal theories of your case? Number one. Number two, state each fact and document which you rely on to prove it. It's only two questions. And I can spend hundreds of hours very early on in the litigation trying to scramble around and provide this information to the other side. And don't think that if they're used with me, I'm not going to come back on the other side. And what you're doing is you're making a lot of busy work for lawyers who are going to get paid for it, and the public is going to end up paying the bill for it. And from the standpoint of looking after the public, I think it's a gross mistake because it just isn't necessary. That's all I have to say.
Senator Carson.
Well, Tom, isn't it necessary to find out most of these, unless you're still, and I don't mean you, but unless one still believes in kind of the adversary or justice by ambush kind of theory, you have to find these questions out somewhere. Now, we use, for instance, a demurrer. Will you frequently be substituted for finding out what a theory of the case is? And I've tried to use that time and time again to find out whether some of them you can't tell whether they're coming on contract or tort. And it would have been nice to have an interrogatory to say, you know, are you coming on contract or tort? And most of these answers, don't you have to find out anyway to prepare your case?
Well, my experience has been, I don't know what your pleading practice is here, but if we don't know whether it's contract or tort, by motion we say that they'd be properly combined too, and you pin them down right there in a single count. That's the advantage, in my judgment, of the code pleading system. You don't have to wait until you get into the federal court and get a pretrial order to determine what the theory is. I think the pleading system is such that you can and do know the basis of the pleading. If you don't, then it isn't properly stated. As long as you have the code pleading system, I don't think the fact that you ask for a legal theory is important, because I think you've got them pinned down very precisely in the code system as to a legal theory. And if it isn't pinned down in the pleading, then I think the pleading is subject to attack. The other thing is, you know, for years, in Portland, for instance, where I practice, and that's what I know the most, some of the biggest abuses were the dilatory motions. Move to strike severe and all these strange things. Finally, this has died down. But now, what the federal court has done and what we're asking to do here is more motions, more arguments, more court appearances, more lawyers' time to argue out who has to answer what. And then the punitive aspect here of making one side or the other pay attorney's fees, and even I think assessing them against the lawyer personally who may have recommended against answering a particular question a certain way. That entails a hearing on the reasonableness of attorney's fees. You're calling expert witnesses. And, you know, interrogatories, you talk among lawyers that try a lot of cases in both courts, and you'll find a definite swing of lawyers away nowadays from the federal court and preferring to go into the state court. And this is something that's happening because of the expense and time consumption of the federal court.
Senator Carson.
I take it the answer would be, generally, you have to find it out anyway. All we're arguing about is what is the best means,
right,
and by
right,
which to find these
right
answers.
Right.
Senator Cook.
All right, now you made the statement that you could pose one question which said, what are your legal theories? Now, it was my understanding that the interrogatory dealt with a request for statements of fact, and I've just been looking here on line 22 and 23 on page 2. It says, may be used to inquire into any matter within the scope of Section 4 of this Act, and I don't find anything in Section 4 of this Act that would allow you to inquire as to a legal theory.
Right, what facts do you intend to rely on to prove your case?
Well, that's the other question. There are
that's
two.
That's facts.
All right. No, the first one you said that this would permit you to ask just two questions. Number one, what are your legal theories? Well, I don't find anything in this bill that would allow you to inquire as to legal theories.
Well, I'm not so sure that that can't be done, and if it is done, your idea would be that it's not allowed. That would eliminate one question. All I'd have to do is say, what are the facts you intend to rely on at the time of trial?
And do you think that with the 25 restriction here that you could use that one broad question and require them to set forth in a response to an interrogatory every item of fact that they're going to propose at time of trial? Is that allowed under the federal practice? Can you do that under the federal practice?
Bruce Spaulding did a beautiful job on them with two of them in the federal court. And those were exactly the type of questions that were asked. And the other thing is, if there's something wrong with it, then I have to file a motion, I have to go in and start over again in the court, I have to schedule it, lawyers have to go over and argue it. If I'm wrong, the court has the right to assess attorney's fees. We can have another hearing to call in expert witnesses.
Now let me make sure that I understood your question correctly. Are you now not asserting that under this bill that's before us that I could pose a question asking you to state your legal theories? Or do you believe that that is in this bill?
I think that's within the scope of this bill.
And then you're also saying that you believe that with only one question and not 25, you could ask the other party to document every fact he intends to prove.
Yes.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to, before we finish today, to ask Austin Crowe to respond and comment.
Austin has signed up on several more bills.
Well, may I ask him now to respond, to comment on this comment of Tom Cooney on these two questions?
Well, first of all, in the federal court...
Sit up at the table.
In the federal court, I don't know of any time when someone who's come in and asked that one question. Now, Mr. King mentioned to me that in one case he asked one question. Please state the facts that you will rely upon to prove the question of scienter or intent in a case. Now, I don't know that there's anything so horrible about that sort of a question. I think as far as asking 25 questions, if one lawyer wants to say, set forth all the facts that you're going to rely on for your case, I think he's going to run into a lot of trouble, and I don't think any lawyer would really dare do that in the federal court because of the problems that you can run into doing that.
What would be those problems? What would prevent him from doing that?
Well, I think that as far as I'm concerned, any time you're in the federal court and the judge senses that you're trying to abuse the rules that are providing for interrogatories, he has all the tools available to him, and I think you've got to remember that when the tools are put in there, you're taking into consideration the bad lawyer, the one or two lawyers who may abuse the whole system, and you have to have something so that you can control them. That doesn't mean that 99% of the lawyers are not going to use the rules effectively and according to the intent of the statute so that you use your 25 questions, you don't have any problems with them. The problem is that you and I know that there are some lawyers who are going to be arbitrary and difficult, and you have to have your rules set up so that they can't do intentional things to subvert the intent of the rules. That's why you have to have those provisions in there. It's awfully easy to come in here and raise all sorts of horror stories and say, well, you know, you can have 10 or 15 different hearings, but that's not, as a matter of fact, what happens. In the rare instance where you have a lawyer who's acting improperly, you have to have these tools available, but 99% of the time that you don't.
What about the question, the right to ask a question about what are your legal theories? Do you think that would be proper under this bill?
I didn't think it was proper under the bill myself, as far as asking what your legal theories are.
Yeah,
Mr. Cooney?
Yeah.
Let me just read precisely the language in Section 4. This is the scope. It's on page 5. For all forms of discovery, now, interrogatories fall in that category. Parties may inquire regarding any matter not privileged, which is relevant to the subject matter involved in the pending action, suit, or proceeding, whether it relates to the claim or the defense. Now, the claim is your legal theory. The defense is your legal theory.
I think perhaps, Senator Cook, the answer probably is this. If, as Mr. Cooney says, in the state court, under the code pleading, you have to set forth your theory, you're not going to run into too many problems about finding out what the nature of the theory is if it's set forth properly in the pleadings. If it's not, then maybe it's a proper thing to make some inquiries into. I don't have any...
We're advising you have to follow our regular procedure.
What I'm concerned with, and I know sometimes that it is hard to... motions and demurs to find out the theory of the other party, and sometimes it's impossible, and so maybe this is a way to do it. You can't seem to get at it through our standard procedural forms to find out what they're driving at.
Thank both of you very much. Harold Darren.
Chairperson, members of the committee, I also am a member of the Oregon State Bar. My name is Harold Darren, however, I do not speak for the Oregon State Bar in this matter, but rather as the presiding referee for the hearings division of the Workman's Compensation Board. The board has asked me to appear to speak to Senate Bill 2257, 2258, and 2259 in a matter that is of concern to them. I put on the sheet that it's again that I speak against in a question mark because I do not speak to the bill as it applies to court actions or proceedings. But we need some clarifying language, we feel, to indicate that this proposed legislation is restricted to court action suits or proceedings. This particular approach was taken also by the board in the House Judiciary Committee, and the matter was established by some appropriate dialogue to establish legislative intent that the proposed legislation did only apply to court action suits or proceedings. This was done specifically with reference to House Bill 2258, and I was out of the state at the time. 2257 and 2259 were heard, but I believe something along the same line took place. We suggested an amendment to the bill stating on page, well, at any particular appropriate place, but for example in section 1 on page 2, line 5, that right following the word proceeding, that language be inserted stating in any court in the state. The House Judiciary Committee, on the other hand, decided against that and established the legislative intent to their satisfaction through dialogue. We believe that these matters should be left to the rulemaking procedure for the administrative agency such as ours. We handle a great number of hearings in a court setting type of structure, but we allow in our procedure through the administrative rules written interrogatories, and is referenced specifically to House Bill 2257. We believe this legislation, if the intent is not so established as we would like to see it, would restrict the use of our written interrogatory procedure rather than expand it, as the attorneys that have represented the Oregon State Bar fully in support of the committee have placed it before you in reference to court proceedings. We go beyond the written interrogatory to a party and allow it to be used also for the taking of evidence from witnesses, and primarily in our proceedings from medical practitioners, rather than taking their deposition and going to additional expense both of the time of the attorneys, the claimants, the employers, and the doctors, allow the use of written interrogatories. We feel that in reference to 2257 specifically, this would limit our practice and procedure rather than expand it, because it is limited in House Bill 2257 to written interrogatories to a party. Also, as to the, expanded use of discovery, I believe Mr. Kirkpatrick pointed out that there were some additional features of House Bill 2257. I believe you'll find them also in the other bills that expand the use of discovery, which would be unsatisfactory in a sense in an administrative setting, because we are dealing mainly, particularly with workman's comp and with safety hearings, with lay people who are representing themselves rather than being able to go to an attorney for advice, and we try to keep it that way as much as possible, as many of you have heard concerning throughout this session and others concerning the escalating cost of workman's compensation. I would ask, if you will, Madam Chairperson, that verification for the proposed idea of establishing legislative intent can be verified by a direct question to Mr. Kirkpatrick, which I'm sure that he will agree that the Senate or the Oregon State Bar Committee on Practice and Procedure perceives this only as applying to court proceedings, actions, and suits rather than administrative proceedings.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
Do you think in order for an interrogatory law to work effectively that it should be extended to witnesses as well as to parties?
I don't believe I would speak to that, Senator. I feel that in the sense of administrative proceedings it does, because it facilitates that, but I would hate to see in instances of court proceedings person who is only indirectly involved be put to additional expense in, with the sanctions that are provided in this bill. I might also point out as an amplification of that that we do not have the sanctions in the administrative rules for failure to answer or respond to the written interrogatories. We use it as a permissive thing with the, in an attempt to elicit that evidence. If it isn't forthcoming on a voluntary basis, why then the parties then are forced to resort to depositions.
Thank you.
Well, why would you be against having these powers then? If what you have now is strictly voluntary, and wouldn't it be, let's assume that this bill were amended to make it clear that this is available in any proceedings, whether it be administrative proceedings, suit, or action, but that the intent of the bill would not be to limit any existing powers that you might have under your rules to seek interrogatories on a purely voluntary basis.
No, I would only ask, Senator, are you couching this in the terms of application to administrative proceedings?
Yeah. While we're talking, that's what your proceedings is very similar to an administrative proceedings, as I see it.
But they are administrative.
They are administrative proceedings. And I'm suggesting that if this is suitable for a hearing in a regular court, then I find it difficult to understand why it's not also suitable in your kind of hearing.
It is, Senator, in that we go, but our problem is we go beyond this. And if you make the, if this is established that it is also applicable to administrative proceedings, then we perceive that this limits our use of written interrogatories.
So now
rather than allowing them in the manner that we use them now.
But right now you say that your powers have no teeth, and whatever you get by interrogatory is purely voluntary.
That's correct.
And so what I'm suggesting, what would be wrong if we were to follow this theory to put in a notwithstanding to say that nothing in here would be intended to limit any existing powers of any existing, I'm trying to think of a word for it, court, board, etc., might currently have to obtain or to put interrogatories or to permit interrogatories. I can't see how you really object to that.
Well, the only problem that we have it in that sense, Senator, I would feel, would be that we are trying in administrative proceedings, particularly in workman's compensation and in the safety hearings field, to encourage the use, and this, particularly in the safety hearings, was sanctioned by the legislature either one or two sessions ago to provide for more personal representation rather than representation by attorneys. And there are many lay people that do not understand all of the ramifications that can come about from an from a law such as this, and to impose sanctions in this nature would happen upon many of them, that they would be subject to the sanctions without really knowing what they were doing. I'll speak more directly to that if you would permit me to carry over when we get into House Bill 2258 in the application of the admissions request.
We have a very tight time problem. Thank you very much. James Griswold.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I am Jim Griswold. I am an attorney in Portland, Oregon, the firm of Green and Griswold. I've been in private practice since about 1950. I'm engaged in practice only on the plaintiff's side. We do no defense work, or we do no criminal work at all to speak of, as far as our office is concerned. I'm here today primarily to speak against House Bill 2257. I think at the House level, when this bill was presented before them, my partner, Grover Green, my partner since 1950 or so, Grover Green spoke. He was on the committee. He took part in presenting the dissenting report, as I understand it, on the committee report that went to the state bar. We've talked about this many times. Our views are identical. He feels very strongly against written interrogatories in state court, as I do. In filing of cases, we stay out of federal court every chance we get to stay away from written interrogatories and other procedures that the federal court has that we do not. We have, up till today, seen specifically situations where the right to bring in third parties, which is by state decision, but the cross-claims, things of these nature, which are in our statutes and come from federal courts, federal rules of civil procedure, are just not working under our state practice. We do not feel that, that written interrogatories should be a part of our state practice. I could tell you of two cases, most similar, what happened to us. Both were filed in federal court, both were products liability cases. Each was against a different automobile manufacturer. In the one case, I decided to add the local dealer as a defendant. I did that. This destroyed federal diversity. That case was then sent to state court and tried there. In federal court, shortly after the case, and they both filed at about the same time, shortly after the case was filed in federal court, the large defense firm served upon me 80-some, and I know there's a 25 limit, but served upon me a number of written interrogatories to be answered by the plaintiff, all matters which are normally answered every day in depositions. We screwed around with the objections to the interrogatories, requests for admissions, the production of documents, and all of these things that we do in federal court. At the same time, the other case was proceeding in the normal course of depositions in state court. We tried the state court case, we won it, and it was on appeal, and opinion was down from our Supreme Court before the case was ever tried in federal court. I made 6 or 8 appearances in federal court objecting, or on one side or the other, as to the form of interrogatories or the request for admissions or whatever they might be. I just use this as an example as to what can happen to federal plaintiffs if the written interrogatories are adopted. I don't intend here to answer all of the statements that have been made by those members of the Oregon State Bar who are in favor of written interrogatories. I today am a poor person to sit here in front of you and argue against interrogatories. I just returned from spending a full week of hide-and-go-seek in New York City with a drug company trying to find out in a state court...
drug company?
Against a drug company. Trying to find out in a state court proceeding who knew what about this particular drug. And I'll have to admit that I came back after the 3 most frustrating days of my life, knowing little more than I knew when I went back. I received absolutely no cooperation from local counsel or New York counsel. I am going to have to get the information I need in another way. If I were in federal court, I could get it by interrogatories. But even with this case and the serious injuries involved in that matter, and the information that I need so very, very badly, I still feel that in the long run I'll have it, and that I'm better off not having interrogatories in the state proceeding than I would be with them. I am better off generally for all of my clients, generally. Although as to that case, I got hurt last week. I have nothing more to say. I just wanted to mention these few examples to you rather than arguing. There's a strong dissent. A strong feeling among many members of the bar that written interrogatories should not be a part of our state practice, and I am here just as one of them to express that to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Senate Bill 2258, Austin Crowe.
Madam Chairman, I don't think there's anything that I should add to that particular bill that I didn't say that related to all three of them before.
Laird, did you want to say anything more on the other two bills?
I'll
please carry three friends here. For the record, my name is Larry Kirkpatrick, School of Law, University of Oregon. I'm chairman of the Procedure and Practice Committee of the Oregon State Bar this year. I think this bill is less complex and probably considerably less controversial than the previous one. This does not incorporate a new procedure into Oregon practice, but simply amends an existing procedure. Oregon currently does have a statute, ORS 41.625, that provides for requests for admission, but the requests are limited to the genuineness of a document or the genuineness of a physical object. The statute serves a very useful purpose in that it enables counsel before trial to know whether the note that they're suing upon or the contract or the document is going to be contested at trial, whether there's going to be any question about whether that is the genuine document that was signed by the clients, if the procedure to resolve this in advance. The problem with the Oregon statute is that it's very limited. It doesn't apply to any issues of fact. And many other states, and certainly the federal rule, Federal Rule 36, extend this procedure to issues of fact as well as the genuineness of documents. For example, in the current Oregon practice, there's no penalty on the defendant who denies the corporate status of a plaintiff. It's a corporation. And the plaintiff could have to be prepared to come into trial and prove the corporate status, even though at trial the opposing party may change their mind and not really contest this issue. But the fact that there's no way to smoke out the opponent and to establish in advance of trial whether this issue is really going to be contested means that litigants have to go to extra trial preparation, and then there's no penalty on the opposing side if the other side really doesn't contest it, or if it's successfully and easily proved at trial. The party putting on the proof has to bear that burden. Under the federal procedure,
are you saying that every time there's an allegation and they're under this and there's a denial, that under this discovery, you would then have to, at that point, pick out which ones you're going to stand on? For instance, corporate existence. Let's suppose I just suspicion
basic
that your corporation is not truly incorporated, and I have to cut or fish bait on that, and if I choose, even though my information is such that you are not truly incorporated, or that's usually what happens, is the pleading is an incorrect corporate name, a sloppy plaintiff's work, and they don't figure it out, so I deny it. And if I stick with it and the court found it close enough, then I pay a penalty?
Only, Senator, if the court finds that you had no reasonable ground, you might prevail on the matter. Section 6 of the bill, subsection 6 of Section 2, only allows sanctions against you if the court finds there was no reasonable basis for you denying it. So if you have any witnesses or ambiguity as to why you continue to deny it, that would be solved.
Gotcha.
So that's the basic penalty section. It can only be imposed, require the party opposing the request for admission to pay the cost of putting on that evidence, only in case the court finds there's no reasonable basis. That is the penalty sanction.
Okay, thank you.
Do you want to say anything on the other bill?
The other bill, I believe I'll just submit written testimony on that. That simply amends an existing statute also. Mr. King from our committee will be making more comments on that. The existing statute there is 41.615, which is the motion to produce statute. The statute was originally adopted in Oregon based on the original version of Federal Rule 34. Federal Rule 34 has been subsequently amended, and this simply incorporates the subsequent amendments to Federal Rule 34, which basically eliminate the requirement of having to file a motion, an affidavit, showing a good cause, and obtaining a court order in order to get production of documents by the opposing side. So it would simply be a time-saving procedure. It would save the attorneys the time, it would save the court the time of having to go get the order and file the motion and affidavit. Only if the production is opposed is it necessary to contact the court. So it would reduce the expense and burden upon litigants of having to obtain such orders. Mr. King may want to elaborate on that in greater detail, and I have a written statement I'll submit to the committee in support of that.
There is no Mr. King signed up.
I believe I did sign the sheet originally.
Oh.
2259.
Right. Okay. Mr. King?
Thank you.
Chairperson, members of the committee, Laird started into this bill, and I'll second what he said with a little more detail, if you don't mind. The bill primarily limits the requirement of getting a court order before production. You just file a request to produce. You only go into court then if the other side refuses to produce the item. There are some other changes in the bill that you might want to consider. Section 2, subsection 4, does codify the Supreme Court decision in the Southern Pacific versus Bryson case. It does provide that request for documents that are otherwise obtainable prepared in anticipation of litigation or for trial, buyer for another party, so forth and so on, may be obtained only upon showing that the party seeking the request has substantial need of the material. I was not on the committee when this bill was prepared, but I believe that is a codification of the Supreme Court holding in the Bryson case. One of the questions that has been raised about this bill is the provision in here that if the party doesn't produce in response to the request and the other party files a motion, then the court may impose attorney's fees in the event that, and I think this is the important part, where the court finds that the opposition, the court may impose attorney's fees unless the court finds that the opposition to the motion was substantially justified. In other words, attorney's fees will not be imposed in every case where an attorney refuses to turn over a document or refuses to produce, but only where the court finds that the opposition was not justified. There is a provision in here for sanctions if a party fails to comply. There's a long list of them, but the committee will note that they are the same as the present provisions under ORS 41.615. There's also a provision now to allow protective orders. There is a protective order provision for depositions only, a motion to take a deposition presently under 45.181. The new bill would expand that so that in the event someone filed a request for production of documents, you could obtain a protective order against producing documents and various other means of discovery. The various items for which you can obtain a protective order are set out on subsection 5 under sections A through H. The section 5 is a just a direct quote from the federal statute, Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 26B1, as to what evidence may be obtained under the request for production. Beginning with section 6, there's a lot of language there, but it's primarily just, in fact, it is just amendments to various provisions of the statute. So basically what we come down to, I believe, in this bill is making it easier to obtain production of documents and codifying the Bryson rule and allowing additional protective orders where necessary.
Thank you. Mr. Martin, did you want to say anything more?
I think most of everything I would say would be covered. I didn't want to appear and say I'm in favor of all three bills, but I think the time is getting late and we've taken quite a bit of time already.
Thank you. Mr. Sampson is gone. Tom Cooney.
I just had a couple of comments about this, and one of them is a trap that exists in this bill as well as in the federal rules, and I would ask this committee to give consideration to it. In the demand for admissions, if they're not answered within 30 days, they're automatically admitted. It's an automatic default on that factor, and I would recommend that you have some, but that's all right, but that we have some notice requirement or something so that the lawyer that has those served on him, his mind or his memory is tickled or jogged, so that we don't end up with these admissions by default. And the reason for it is frequently it's the practice to include demands for admissions along with interrogatories. The interrogatories have to be answered, but there is not a requirement of automatic admission if they're not answered within the prescribed time. Whereas in the demands for admissions, if you don't have that answer in within the 30 days, they're deemed admitted. And it can be a very, very serious trap in both the federal and the state courts. So I'd ask that. There's nothing wrong with the automatic admission of 30 days, but some type of an application to the court or a notice or something so it doesn't go without seeing it.
Whereabouts in the bill? With
that's on page 2, line 15.
This is 2258.
Well, I would just say that they're deemed, unless within 30 days after service, they're quit.
If it is so stated in the demand?
No. The matter shall be deemed admitted.
within 30 days after service, and 5 days notice or 3 days notice of non-running, what I'm trying to suggest, language would be really quite fit into that phraseology. With the requirements of this rule, it may order either that the matter is in fact admitted or that an amended answer be served. In other words, it's within the capability of the trial court, and it's something that would normally be a jury matter, to order without jury trial that a certain fact be admitted as a matter of law. And I think this is a requirement that presents a constitutional question.
What your suggestion is that on line 6, one should take out the words either through the end of that line, and then on line 7, take out the first four words, and wouldn't that solve it?
Yes.
Is that it?
And then I would ask you to consider seriously whether in all of these procedural devices you really want to get into the business of having trials and assessments of attorney's fees back and forth on each side. Because this procedure is going to encourage lawyers to make demands for admissions. If I deny them and I lose the lawsuit, I'm going to be faced with a demand and a hearing again for attorney's fees. There are many reasons. You may not oppose the identification of a document, but you may, for a reason of what the intent of the person was that wrote the document, choose not to admit its genuineness because you want that witness on the stand to explain what he did. And procedurally, it may be an advantage to the plaintiff or the defendant to have the other side call that person. And if you have to admit under threat that later on you may be stuck attorney's fees because you didn't admit the genuineness of the document, you're being stripped of your right in cases where intent or state of mind are involved from having the jury hear the explanation of the witness at the time the document's introduced. And for that reason, it presents a limitation on a proper and orderly presentation of the facts.
Where in the bill is this provision relating to attorney's fees?
It's on page 3, line 12 through all the way down to 30.
What's your next point?
That's it.
Okay, thank you very much. Harold Barron.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Harold Barron again, appearing for the Workman's Compensation Board. Basically, my same request applies to Senate Bill 2258 and 2259 as I had presented to the committee. Referring to Senate Bill or House Bill 2257. I would again make that same request. I would also ask at this time of Mr. Kirkpatrick to verify my statement as to 2257 as it applies to all three bills, that was not the intent of the bar committee.
Sir, the committee's intent taken care of.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairperson. I would also like to point out that with reference to House Bill 2258, in the process of administrative hearings, this poses a real problem because we do have so many lay individuals that represent themselves. They request a hearing in either workman's comp or in safety hearing cases, and then they come up later and represent themselves. We would indicate that we feel that this particular provision would put many of those in effect out of hearings because they would have this served on them, and the type of people that we have coming in and many times at administrative hearings are not sophisticated enough to realize the implications that would be involved with refusing to make this demand. Therefore, they would
say, I'm not going to answer anything, and they would then come into hearing and find out that the matters that they had been requested to answer were deemed admitted, and they had nothing left to say as far as the hearing was concerned. If the committee will recall, also last legislative session, I believe it was, the employers, even corporate employers, were allowed to represent themselves through office managers, bookkeepers, etc., in safety hearing cases, and the same procedure would apply. I would make only one illustration as to that particular problem, and that had to do with the safety hearing for what we would term as, say, a ma and pa chicken farm. However, it happened to be a corporate structure. The husband was going to testify, and therefore the mother or the wife presented the questioning of the witnesses and her husband, etc. The citation that was charged to that employer contained 85 violations. And in an attempt to simplify the hearing, a request was made at the time of the hearing by the referee as to whether some of the issues could be eliminated, and she indicated that she was not going to concede anything. They went through 85 violations of testimony and had to make individual dispositions of those. I would suggest that that woman would have taken, and that family would have taken, exactly the same attitude with reference to the service upon them of a request for admissions. And consequently, they would have appeared at the time of the hearing and found out they had nothing left to talk about, because everything that they had proposed to talk about had already been deemed to have been admitted.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, before you, just a note while I'm thinking of it here, to Diane, it seems to me that possibly under the first point that Tom raised on page 2, say line 22, we might want to consider provision that would allow the court to relieve a party of his failure to make a timely denial on a showing of good cause. What would you think of that, Craig? You think that might be a way to approach their time?
I prefer the reminder system rather than another court hearing. The reminder system just says, you know, in 3 days the time is going to run and your demands for admission are admitted unless you answer. And that way there's no court hearing required. What you're suggesting would solve the problem, but it does require a motion to set aside the effect of the time lapse on good cause shown. Is more lawyer time more expensive time?
Why don't you prepare something and send it?